So, yes, you are listening to The Wine Show Australia, and we're very, very, very happy to be joined by our next guest. It's Kim Chalmers. Good morning to you, Kim.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm so well.
No, it's a pleasure. And you're also, we've got Ewan Proctor up in Healesville. Where are you joining us from this morning, Kim?
Hi, Ewan. I'm joining you from Mildura. So our main HQ is up here in the Murray-Darling region. So this is where our nursery is based and our winery, although the majority of the wines people would know from us come from our Heathkit vineyard. So we've got two sites in Victoria.
Yeah, and we'll get to all that in a second. But so we've been sort of sweltering away yesterday and then it's cold again today. It's like 17. What's it been like up in Mildura?
Well, kind of the same, but it was 43 yesterday. It'll be 33 today, so.
Jeez. Yeah, wow. That is some super hot stuff. So the Chalmers story, let's go back. It was a bit of a family vineyard, wasn't it, to begin with?
Yeah, so I'm second generation. My parents kicked off this whole crazy shebang that we do now, and it started really with Grapevine Nursery. Although they were growing a few wine grapes first, they really got stuck into the whole scene that we're well entrenched in now. In the sort of late 80s, they started a grapevine nursery, and then through the 90s, obviously lots of people were planting vines at that stage in Australia. Yeah. So the nursery was busy, but it was really busy with only sort of a handful of grape varieties, the ones that we commonly know and that are widely planted around the world. So they took that as an opportunity to kind of delve into what else might be possible, and so they were involved along with other people at the time in Australia, but we were particularly involved in introducing a lot of new Italian varieties. So some new clones of things that had already started to make a name here, like Sangiovese and Nebbiolo, but lots of stuff that hadn't landed on Australian shores before, like Nera d'Avola or Sagrantino or Aglianico. So through in the late 90s, that's when they sort of got into all of that. And from the early 2000s, all those varieties came in. So through their nursery and through also growing grapes, making wines ourselves and also selling grapes to other winemakers, we've been able to, you know, spread the word and get these varieties out and across Australia and in people's glasses.
So would it be fair to say when it comes to these, in inverted commas, sort of more alternative, new or whatever, kind of up-and-coming varieties in Australia, of course, that there's not many places that people can go, well, winemakers can go to get their material from? Is it basically your nursery, and do Yolumba do a bit of that stuff? Or
Yolumba do great work. Some of the regional associations and things, like, you know, in the Adelaide Hills, Harndorf Hill with Gruner and Adelaide Hills Vine Improvement, and there's some also sort of vine improvement associations in South Australia that do importing of new varieties. It used to be the domain of the government, of course, but like other things, that sort of funding, you know, falls away, because you might bring in 50 varieties and 10 might turn out really popular and the other 40 might sit there for 10, 20, 30 years, may never get taken up, may get taken up later. So it is a kind of an investment that you don't necessarily get a return on.
Yeah.
But it's really exciting, and some of the things that have been sitting around in our collection are starting to pick up pace now. But yeah, there are a few, Yolumba definitely, and there's ARM Nursery in WA who also brings in some materials. So it's coming to the nurseries mainly to do that sort of work now.
So we had Corinna from Oliver's Taranga on last year, and she was talking about Falanghina and,
yes,
like, you know, how tough it, like, how are you just going to get people to understand what that is? Did they get that from you? Were you one of the pioneers for that?
Yeah, so we introduced Falanghina into Australia for the first time in 2015, and we made the first wine in 2018 in our project range, which is where we sort of try out new things. But Heathkit Falanghina has been part of the Chalmers proper range now since 2020.
Cool.
And it goes really well, and I think that's a great one to sort of hone in on. Being a new variety into Australia, it's not that well known yet. It's actually not that well known in Italy. It's a Campanian variety, but it's got all the ticks in the boxes for us. So when we're looking at working with a new variety, we're obviously, we sort of evolved as a wine and viticulture family in Mildura. So we're used to heat, we're used to dry, and the region in Heathkit where we've established our vineyards right up north. So it's also quite warm, which is, it can be surprising for people. I'm sure you've talked about it on the show before, but Heathkit is a long, skinny region, and the bottom borders on Macedon, which is, you know, very cold, and the top's heading up towards the Murray River. So we're up near the top. So Falanghina there, we're able to grow and pick at, you know, a kind of potential alcohol of about 12.5 to 13, but with the kind of acid numbers of a German Riesling. So, you know, 2.95 pH or, you know, 10 TA, which is
quite high.
With our climate change future-proofing hat on, being able to make, you know, delicate aromatic, you know, with a bit of structure and plenty of acid in a warm climate, you know, that's a good example of the backbone of what our program's always been about. It's been about working with the conditions you've got, so not all just pulling up stumps and moving to Tasmania, but actually, you know, like loving where you live and working out how to work with it.
Yeah, we've had Adam Foster on the show before, talking about that more sub-regionality with Heathcote, and I know his property's right down there, Toobarak. But if you jump over his back fence, as you say, Kim, you're in Macedon, so it's
it's all granitic boulders and, you know, it's Riesling country, and then up where we are, it's, you know, the big bold Shiraz and Syrah and things like that. So it's quite interesting as a region, and with the, you know, the fault line and the soil. So it's for a... It's a bit of a one-stop shop for lots of different reasons, Heathcote, as a wine region.
Yeah. And you would have travelled through Campania a million times, I imagine, given your Italian sort of love of.
I would love to have been a million times, but I've been once or twice.
Oh, no, but also Ewan, who's here too. I mean, you would have been through a bunch of times, wouldn't you, mate?
Yeah, I've been, I wouldn't say a million, but I was actually lucky to be there this year.
Yeah.
I went down to Salerno and in the back of there around Taurasi. This is a really interesting little spot there for really good red wines, but also really there's those beautiful, crisp sort of seaside Campanian whites, which I think, I love that project, Kim, about thinking, you know, you guys have contributed so much to try to future-proof or at least, you know, give options, I think, is the main thing, right? You know, there's always a bit of a risk and reward thing for that. But,
Look, I also think that going back to what I mentioned before about the handful of varieties, like we got 62 GIs or whatever in Australia and they all grow Shiraz.
And Chardonnay.
They all grow Chardonnay as well, probably.
Yeah. No, they do. Yeah.
You know, they're adaptable varieties or whatever, but it doesn't give us a sense of regionality or uniqueness. So it's also giving people more opportunities to find something that they can do that is special for them with their patch of dirt. So, you know, like having more colours in the palette, basically, and more opportunities to fine tune exactly your the viticulture and the variety with the site. So, you know, and of course, you know, being a nursery person, would be remiss of me not to even also mention rootstocks there. I mean, you know, we can adapt to our site so well by using some of those characteristics too. So choosing the right variety, choosing the right rootstock, and putting all the effort into how you grow things can only improve the wine.
Now, Kim, just for our listeners who may not be as au fait with viticultural terms, what can you explain what rootstock is, and just explain a little bit how you make selections of clones and then how you plant them and that sort of stuff? Just a basic sort of idea.
Yeah, so the idea of grafted vines is that you can take a bottom half of the plant, which is where the roots are in the ground, and then you can graft in the top half of what you want. So, you know, think, go down to Bunnings, you grafted tomatoes, you know. They put a hardy rootstock and they put a good fruiting variety on the top. It's exactly the same with vines, grapevines.
Yep.
And so what you want to do is you want to choose a rootstock that has specific characteristics that will help you. So it might have phylloxera resistance if you're in a phylloxera risk area, or it might have drought tolerance if you're in a low rainfall area. Those rootstock varieties are not vinifera. So vinifera are the grapes we make wine from, wine grapes, that they originate from Europe.
Yeah.
But there's lots of other types of grapevines around the world. In Asia and America mainly are the ones they use for rootstocks because they are resistant to phylloxera. It was the main reason we started using them. But there's all these other side benefits that you can bring ripening forward or stretch it out, or you can have salt tolerance or whatever. So in terms of building the vineyard for longevity, that's a consideration. The other consideration is your variety. So like what I was saying before about Falanghina, we're in a hot place. In hot places, what do we usually associate with hot climate wine? Too much alcohol, a lot of fruit.
Blousy.
So you want to find a variety that can retain its acidity, that perhaps ripens a bit later, so it's not ripening right in the middle of a heat wave and becoming quite high in sugar.
Yeah.
So, you know, Chalmers is very much a viticulture family. You know, we make wine, but that's almost sort of a side...
Side hustle.
A side hustle. It's a translation of our grapes, really.
Oh, what a great phrase, a translation of our grapes. That's fantastic. I'm going to write, that's beautiful.
So all the effort goes into working out what we're going to grow and how we're going to grow it. And then, you know, my husband's the winemaker. He said when he came to work for us, he used to work in McLaren Vale with Steve Pannell, and he trained in Germany. And when he came to work for us, he said, "I'm not really a winemaker anymore. I just go in and out and check the temperature of the tanks." Because we do, you know, we do a lot of work in the vineyard, so that what happens in the winery is quite minimal, really.
Yeah. It's wine growing, really, isn't it? And then you move grapes somewhere, then they get moved into another place, and they go into a bottle, and that's it.
So with clones are basically subtypes of a variety. So some varieties mutate easily and some don't. So like Pinot, for instance, there's lots of clones, or Sangiovese, there's lots of clones. Some varieties like Fiano perform pretty similarly all over the place and don't really mutate much. So a clone is just a version of that variety that's adapted somehow along the way in evolution to be a little bit different from the other one. But genetically, DNA-wise, they are the same.
Yeah.
But a clone might just perform slightly differently. It might have bigger berries, or it might have a lower yield or whatever. So for us, what we often recommend, if we do have access to multiple clones, which is not always the case in Australia because maybe we only imported one or two, but if you do have multiple clones, you know, our belief and what we talk to our nursery customers about is polyclonality is really good. It gives you a bit of a buffer.
Flexibility.
That's right.
Yeah.
One clone might be more frost sensitive than the other, or one might bud burst earlier. So, okay, the early bud burst variety got frosted, but the later one didn't. So, you know, you're sort of, or one might be higher acidity in a year when the other one is a bit more high in sugar. So, you know, you can sort of work with multiple clones. We don't have that luxury with a lot of stuff. Narrodavola, there's only one clone in Australia. And, you know, when you think about that, that Narrodavola that we introduced in the late 90s, when you go through the process of bringing in a variety, anyone who's ever flown in from overseas knows the biosecurity regulations are pretty strict.
Yeah.
You can't just waltz on in with some grapevines. The cuttings get sent in, they get confiscated at customs, they get taken straight to a secure facility that's run by the government, and then they will grow on those cuttings in a greenhouse for you.
Yep.
And at the end of the quarantine period, if they pass their health checks, there's no nasties, you get one pot plant. So
that's
one pot plant.
Oh, my Lord.
So one little plant about 50 centimetres high.
Wow.
And yes, whatever you do, don't kill the pot plant. but think about that. So Narrodavola didn't exist in Australia before. We all know it's on every shelf. It's on every wine list now. It's growing in a lot of regions. It's really reaching a level of maturity in Australia. It's got sub-regional character that's recognisable in the bottle. And so all of those wines and all of those vines came from that one 50-centimetre pot plant.
That's mind-blowing.
Isn't it? So sometimes we look around these wine lists and things and we feel like, you know, proud great-great-great-grandparents or something, because, you know, it's really cool to have a little piece of that story and to see the grandkiddies grow up and
you
move out
should
of home.
Be
and...
you should be proud. That's a great legacy to leave. And so another variety I was keen to talk about, so we talked about Falanghina as a red variety from Campania.
A white variety
from Campania. But I know that you've also got the Negramaro coming in from Puglia, right? So
So Negramaro was in our first lot of imports, but it's one of those ones that's been a bit of a sleeper. We had a little bit of interest at the start, but haven't sold a lot of vines over the years, and now people are starting to, you know, prick up their ears a bit more.
And that's something that you grow. What's the name of the? You're just out of Mildura. Is it Merbein or Merbein or something?
Merbein.
Yeah, Merbein. Is there something special you have to do with some of these varieties in terms of trellising? So most of our listeners have ever been to, you know, out to the Yarra Valley or something. They see vines and they kind of understand the way that we do that, like a single vertical shoot positioning trellis, all that sort of stuff. Are there bush vines, or do you have like a double cordon? Is there anything you need to do specially with certain varieties up there?
Look, the main thing with our viticulture up here is that, you know, you have to be careful about exposure. In the Yarra Valley, you've probably got north-south rows, so you can get a bit of sun on the grapes to make sure they get ripe. Maybe not in future, but in the past, that would have been the case. All of our rows are oriented east-west, so you think the sun comes up and goes across the top of the row and down the other side, so you're not getting too much sun on the grapes. That's one of the key things. But recently with our Negramaro and also Insolia, which is the Sicilian white, we've done a little project to see how far down we can push water requirement for a grapevine. So if you look at textbooks written by experts all over the world, they say in a cool climate region, 450 millimetres per annum of rainfall is what you need, the minimum you need to be able to grow and produce wine.
Yep.
And in a warm climate, it's more like 650.
Yep.
So we use irrigation, obviously. We have to where we are because the annual average rainfall is 280,
wow.
but we don't always get there.
Yeah.
And so what we've been doing for the last 20 years or so has been refining our techniques to reduce our irrigation, and we're about 2 megs a hectare under the regional average with our water use. So that means in rainfall terms, the average amount of irrigation applied as in equivalent rainfall would be 650 millimetres per annum, and we apply about 450 on our normal vineyard. So we're already quite efficient, but we wanted to test the limits of dry growing. And so we've planted a bush vine planting. So that means individual little trees.
Yeah.
We've actually used the Alborello technique, which is what they use in Sicily, where they have a stake and they tie the foliage up. So in a cooler place, you can do bush vines just self-supported, but because we have so much sunshine, that they just love to grow. And so the canes are long, so we have to trim the top and tie them onto the stake. But we've been doing that for a number of years now, and it's super exciting. Last year, we only applied 48 millimetres of irrigation.
Wow.
And in the previous years, since we've been making wine from this block, the total of water requirement that those vines have used of rainfall and irrigation has been 300 millimetres or less.
So you're like less than half.
Less than half what the textbooks say. Yeah.
Wow.
And the wine is incredible, super full of personality, really interesting. And speaking of the sand and limestone and the blue sky and the red earth, you know, if you get to try the wines, you'll see what I mean. They're in limited production because we only have 700 vines of each. But we this year haven't applied irrigation at all. Of course, we've had plenty of rain.
Yeah.
But what our aim with this block is to try and, test the limit of dry growing. Maybe one day we'll be able to make wine off that block without putting a drop of irrigation on. Be pretty interesting. And so the Jancis Robinson, Max Allen did an article on jancisrobinson.com about the project, just because worldwide it has significance in that, you know, again, right variety, right rootstock, right techniques.
Yeah.
Never mind what the conditions are. If you do all the other things right, you can make great wine. Great wine can be made anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's a really great thing to talk about. And I will also put up on Instagram there's a great Australian Financial Review article.
Yeah.
That I'll put a link to in my LinkedIn, which I think really is talking about that pioneering spirit again and talking about the dirt and what you guys do and some of these things we've been talking about. So we at Uncle Dan's in Alphington, we only sell the Fiano, the Vermentino, and then there's a field blend. So they're all from Heathcote, is that right?
Is it the Montevecchio or the Mother Block?
I think it's the Montevecchio.
Yeah, they're all from Heathcote.
Yeah.
So the Inzolia and the Negro Amaro just joined the fray of Charmers. They're from Murray-Darling. But we've also got a brand out of the Murray-Darling called Mother Block, which, surprise, surprise, is made from our Mother Block. So given that the nursery is based up here and we've got, you know, 100-odd different clones covering about 50 different varieties in our imported collection, we have to grow them somewhere. So, yes, we take cuttings from them, but they also grow grapes. So we're using those grapes now to make a range of wines out of the Murray-Darling called Mother Block, and they're fun, delicious field blends, a white, a rosé, a skin contact, and a red. The red's a Sagrantino-based blend, the white's a Vermentino-based blend, but they've got lots of varieties in there, obviously, because of our diverse plantings, and it's been really good. That's just sort of hit the ground in the last 12 months, and it's been really great to be able to come out with a wine that, you know, speaks from our home country and also hits the market at a really reasonable price point and shows that one of the things that we've always wanted to talk about is that, again, great wine, you know, it can be the $100 a bottle, single vineyard, tiny production, low yield, high density, blah, blah, blah. But it can also just be good wine, delicious, nice blends, texture, savouriness, interest, fruit, etc. And it can pop in under $20 retail.
Oh, easy. Yeah, absolutely.
Or, you know, at 20, 23, they're retailing at. So, you know, a handmade, delicious, you know, field blends. So,
but things you, this is not an accident. Like, you spent 20 years trying to decrease your water footprint, like, and grow these varieties in terms of getting more over. This is not an accident. So I think you can make great wine from anywhere with great care. That's where I'm coming from. So we've 100%. spoken about Falanghina, Fiano. I heard you mention Alianico before and Negro Amaro. Are there a couple, one or two other whites and one or two other red varieties you can talk about in the couple minutes we've got left?
Absolutely. Charmers and Vermentino are pretty synonymous. We made the first Aussie Vermentino in 2004. And it's funny, it's probably the wine that we're most known for, even though it's our, you know, go-to entry point in the Charmers range. So it's a delicious, fresh white with a nice little lick of saltiness and some kind of white nectarine fruit characters. Can be a bit lemony or grapefruity depending on the season. But what Vermentino did for us, I suppose, in the first instance, and it's one that really stood out, is it taught us about warm climate grape growing in terms of, you know, the winemaker's ultimate is small berries, you know, skin to flesh ratio, concentration, et cetera, et cetera. In a warm climate, that doesn't always work because the smaller the berries, the less hydration they have. And on a really hot day, they're going to cook. Whereas big berries have more resilience, which, you know, it's pretty hard to talk to some winemakers about big berried varieties can make really fresh, delicious wine, and about vine balance. So obviously where it's sun, there's a lot of sunshine, you have bigger vines. Yeah. So bigger vines means you need more grapes on there. Otherwise you have too many leaves and not enough grapes.
Yeah.
And then you don't get balanced wine. So it's been a really great process for us. My parents are they're the green thumbs, so they can grow anything. They're amazing. They're amazing at being in tune with the plants, starting to learn how that, like I said, translated into wine, into the glass without, you know, fixing it. So making it just speak of the place. Vermentino was the first thing that we really learned those things from. And, you know, think about the early 2000s, you know, the warm climate white of that time was bold oaked Chardonnay. On the back of that was Sauv Blanc and Pinot Gris, and Vermentino just had this sort of elegance and freshness that was really great to be able to show in that in those sort of conditions, and it's now become our biggest white in the Heathcote region as well. And you know, planting a fresh, crisp, salty white in Heathcote was also something different when we did it. When we moved in, we planted some Shiraz because we didn't want to get trumped out of the region, but we planted lots of white varieties and they've gone so well. I mean, all that beautiful special character that that soil imparts in reds, it gives just as interesting a character in whites.
Yeah, cool. Ewan?
Yeah, I just had a question, Kim, with following on from that, but you know, the amount of reds that you've introduced, and that's sort of dovetailed in at the same time over the last sort of, let's say, 10, 15 years of much more acceptance of rosé.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Is that a thing for you guys in that? My theory would be that rosé is kind of a really good entry point for people to try out, to get familiar with a new variety of red. Now, they're not drinking the red, but they're getting familiar with buying that wine that says Negro Amaro on the bottle, because Negro Amaro makes great little rosés and stuff
right?
Yeah. So how does that have an effect for you guys in terms of what you feel like, you know, the market will take, or even that people are looking at for vineyards?
Yeah, Alianico is a really good example of that. So our rosé is made out of mostly Alianico, bit of Nero d'Avola, a bit of Sagrantino. I wish we sold more dry red Alianico because I love it. I think it's one of the most successful varieties in terms of translation to Australia that we've had. It's very late ripening, it's high acidity, it ripens at low BOMA, so it's not too high in alcohol, and it makes the kind of red wines that I like, which are, you know, structured and acidic and tannic but not heavy. Having said that, the world is all about juicy, slurpable reds right now, so structured, tannic, acidic reds are having a tough time. But Alianico is our top crew red. We only make it in a reserve style when it's a great year, and we don't make much of it, but we're super proud and we're really behind Alianico. However, 90% of our Alianico grapes get made into sparkling Col Fondo, which is a like a method traditional that's undisgorged sparkling rosé, and our table wine rosé, and both those wines go really, really well. And I think savoury varieties make great rosé, you know, Nebbiolo, like you said, Negro Amaro, Alianico, when you've got a bit of tannin, things that have more of that citrus spectrum rather than the than the florals and the red fruits. I think they just work a treat for rosé. And, you know, when it's 43, who wants to drink dry red? So, you know, no wonder we're all fans of rosé in this country.
Yeah. And, you know, I think if you think back to sort of the 2008, 2010, 2012, you know, I was just getting into the industry. You and you are obviously well entrenched, but there wasn't a lot of rosé on the shelf at a Dan Murphy store or wherever you go. And I think, you know, Steve and Leanne up in the Yarra did the rosé revolution, and now they're talking about rosé evolution. We've got so many rosés on the shelf now. It almost can be difficult for customers to choose because they go, I want a dry rosé. I'm like, yeah, well, there's 100. Okay, I want a dry rosé from France. Okay, there's 50, you know, and then it goes down to price. So, yeah, but we do love rosé, and are we going to be drinking a glass of rosé this afternoon, Ewan? That's the big question, mate. Have you got anything stashed away?
Yeah, there'll be rosé.
there will be rosé.
To touch on one other white, you asked me to do two.
Yes.
So just a pie in the sky random one, which is really interesting. Pecorino. So it was one of the ones in our latest import. It's really getting some traction. Lots of people are into it. Speaking of Hunter Valley, Liz Riley, who's a consultant up there, I went and did a presentation there with the new varieties we brought in 2015. There's a whole pocket of producers now working with it in Hunter. We've had great success in Heathcote and here in Mildura, and I think it's going to be a great white variety for Australia going forward, so watch this space.
Pecorino, you heard it first from Kim Chalmers. Thank you so much for sharing some time with us on a Sunday morning on The Wine Show Australia.
No worries. Thank you so much for having me.